Welcome to the PI Podcast, Political Insights for the Palaging Inis. I'm your host, Matt, and with me is my co-host, political scientist, meme lord, na ayaw pa rin maglo hanggang ngayon, Borge.
Ayaw pa rin maglo. Yeah, my family would say that one. PI nating lahat, Borge, you're at your service.
Yes, and this is our first episode in the new year 2022. So happy new year, everyone.
Ay na, 2022
na. We had a long break. Oh, 2022. Or some people would say 2022, like part two. Ah, hindi pa, ano? Hindi pa tapos yung 20. And well, of course, as we all know, I think our year began with a huge surge of COVID. So hope everyone is safe. Mm. I think we were not spared from it. But hopefully, like, well, we survived. I survived actually COVID. So, but thankfully, I'm back. Yay. and we shall begin our new year with a very important topic, especially that we have a lot of new followers from Bicol University. Hello, how do you say, is anyone Bicolano?
Like, magandang umaga sa inyo lahat.
Tagalog na lang. Sige. But so yeah, thank you for joining us. We have a listener there who helped us introduce this podcast to a lot of political science students, and a lot of our current students have follow the podcast, and in benefit to the students, presumably future political scientists, hopefully, we would like, and of course to society in general, we would like to discuss and define our vocation. You and I are political scientists. You know, what is political science and why is it important? And the problem is, and if you can tell from our intro, that there is this stereotype of political science being a pre-law. So, nag-masters na ako, nag-PhD na ako. Hanggang ngayon, ang lola ko, naghihintay pa rin. So, kailan ka mag-law? Kailan ka mag-law? Do you have that thing, same thing bored with your family?
Yeah. I have the same thing. I think they got tired of it, so. But yeah, for during my MA, so, mag-law ko.
Sumuko na sila.
Sino kuha na.
But I don't know. What do you think about this general stereotype of political science? Like, even like, for example, not just our family members, but also like people we meet. Like, I teach political science. Oh, lawyer? Are you a lawyer? Like, Or kahit even your taxi driver or Grab driver. You know, it's like, naglo kayo, sir. But anyway. So yeah, what do you think?
I think, why are we often associated with law? Well, first, it is inherent in our discipline. We also discuss law. We don't engage in that much jurisprudence, but of course, we have public policy. So that's also part of our discipline. And of course, we have public admin and development studies, which are basically spin-offs. Spin-offs. Someone who got in.
Should
I dub them as spin-offs? Okay, they're spin-offs in a sense that they got mixed with other disciplines. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, but public admin is just, you know, trying to be something else. But okay. We're not going to wail on the other disciplines, but it is inherent in our discipline. We also discuss laws. We discuss the formation of laws. We discuss the factors affecting the creation, implementation, evaluation of laws. So, but I think why we are usually associated with law is, first and foremost, I think, and this is a hypothesis. We actually need data for this one. We need data, and I'm throwing it out. How many lawyers are teaching political science right now? So I think that's an empirical question. And for the longest time, lawyers have been seen as, you know, the usual teachers of political science. So so in the teaching level, the level of education, we have yet to establish our distinction, or I think we are establishing it now. But usually associated as a lawyer and nagtuturo. Tapos, again, when you teach political science, the usual, I ask students about this. Yes, and some of our listeners here have been chatting with me. So their professors would talk about laws. So they would force their students to be like law students. So studying practice yan. So, but I think at the core of it, at the end of it, ordinary citizens, ordinary Filipinos would like something practical from political science. That's why we are associated with law, because the legal profession is, of course, a practical one. So, yun yun eh.
Yeah. There actually, that reminds me of this, I believe Ryu Hagbalo in his one of his chapters in the book Adventures in Biblical Science. He actually wrote a chapter on like this teaching of political science. And he actually said that out of the many state universities and even the national universities, only I believe the top three universities, which include at that point, even then he only says at University of the Philippines, Diliman, it was the only department of political science that had a PhD program. Meaning that, of course, to be a political scientist, you need to have advanced degrees, master's, and a PhD. So at the same time, if you wanted to have a widespread, of course, part of the curriculum of teaching political science, I suppose they are undermanned, you know, they lacked the people to teach. That's why they did lawyers. But at the same time, it's the chicken and egg thing. Like, weren't lawyers for their pre-law, didn't they take political science? So the seeds of political science was planted into the education of lawyers. So it's kind of like this weird cycle.
Go ahead.
I mean, he actually laments the fact that even during this time, I think it was in the 1980s where he first wrote this, that there were very few political science, like full-time political scientists. And because in a way, people didn't know what they were for, really. Like, you know, there's this joke where, I mean, I need a doctor, but at least the PhD can tell you, like, at least the philosophy of, like, dying or whatever. What do we tell someone, the person who's dying? You know? But, yeah, you're saying something?
Yeah. When did you write that one? In the 80s, 70s?
Let me check. It is, let me just open it. I'm turning the pages. I've got it right here. We'll just edit this out. 1984.
All right, that's a long time ago. So, our discipline had grown ever since then. So, even our department, meron a PhD in political science,
which is very recent. But yeah,
it is. That's another thing. It's also recent. So, I think the concern that Paolo stated is being alleviated now. So there are more people getting advanced degrees. But still, is it the chicken or egg thing with law? No. We came first. We fucking came first. The study of politics came first.
No. I mean, of course, like in like the world, if you look at the history of the science of the world, of course we did. I think it was even Alan Bloom. I love this line, by the way. Out of all the social sciences, political science is like the oldest discipline, a mother discipline, to the point where she is an old lady that doesn't like to show her age, which means that she has at the same time a huge, what do you call this? A huge legacy, a huge heritage dating back to the ancient Greeks of Aristotle and Socrates and Plato. But for some reason, political science doesn't want to show that age. It tries to be relevant. It tries to be current, and it tries to sometimes even, because of the scientific label, scientific theories are able to predict phenomena. So it's concerned with the present and the future, but does not, in a way, give enough credit to the past.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think
political science is your sassy tita.
The sassy tita, who has a lot of skeletons in her closet. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to see at least an overview, maybe broad strokes for this podcast, of what is the past of political science and also the present, and what can it be its future. Yeah. And I think, since we mentioned this, I think you and I share an appreciation of the classics. So the science of politics came from where, like maybe you could, from what you know, where did it come from and how did it emerge?
Okay, it's good that you said about the political science being an old lady. I think, I dare say this one, but I think philosophy... Philosophy actually emerged alongside the study of politics. And this is evident in the classics, not only in ancient Greece. So you have the pre-Socratics focusing on philosophy. But then again, when it was formalized into an actual discipline by the likes of Plato and then Aristotle. So politics was side by side. Same with the Chinese. So Chinese philosophy, the Taoists, the Confucians, you may see them as, you know, guides to life. But in the classic works, they also provided deep and extensive commentaries on public life, on politics, on sovereignty and ruling. So that's our source. So the organization mm-hmm. of societies into large groups, into polities, into kingdoms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where we began. We tried to make sense of it. We tried to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the weird thing was that it used to be, well, people who could apply political science, or at least the products of political science. Usually, if you look at Aristotle, Niccolo Machiavelli, Cardinal Richelieu, they were actually advisors to kings. Even what we say Confucius was at one point, or at least Confucianism was used to train advisors and ministers to the emperor.
Yeah.
So oddly enough, it was a very specialized field, and it was has a lot to do with, of course, ruling, how to rule
in public service.
In public service.
Yeah.
Even to this day, I suppose at least even Manny Pacquiao recognized he needed a degree in political science before he could continue his political career. Mm-hmm. But it is mostly the discipline for, you know, rulers. But at the same time, like, of course, this lines up with the popular and the, still the dominant definition of politics, whether it be traditional or current, was that it has a lot to do with the government. It has a lot to do with power. And so you think this, of course, it has grown from that. You know, it is not just meant for rulers and the people who make policies, public policy, who implement them, who govern, but also, of course, the education of citizens. In fact, perhaps that's the reason why it made from that transition of the education of ministers and rulers to, of course, the education of citizens. That's why it became the part of the core curriculum. Yeah. Now, I don't know, what else can you say about this, like in terms of this two dimensions of political science being part of our education?
So education of rulers, public servants, and that is quite clear. So another manifestation of this one is political theorists, political philosophers. Mm. Many of them are actually legal theorists.
Mm-hmm.
So you have say international law, you have Grotius, who was also a political thinker as well as a legal theorist. In our case, we have Jean Baudin, who is also a demonologist. That's why I'm dealing with demonism right now. The legal and political professions or political disciplines, they have been tied together for a long time, but it is politics that came first
Right.
Of course. And but for the shift of education, I think that's also clear for the Confucian case.
Mm-hmm.
So Confucius, again, education was only for the wealthy during his time, but he was known to be the first one to actually to establish mass education.
Mm-hmm.
So before we had Saint Jean-Baptiste de La Salle, China had Confucius. Ooh, La Salle. China had Confucius establishing a means for educating ordinary subjects or ordinary people. Mm-hmm. So it's not about only ruling per se. It's also about being a good citizen for the West and being a good part of society, or being a good subject for the East.
Yeah. So in other words, there are these two dimensions that are emerging here. You have, of course, we'll talk about, I think the first part is the science part, which is very technical, which is a high level thinking. It's, you know, scientific, it's theoretical, it's experimental, which is in a way an elite discipline. So not everyone necessarily needs to learn it. But then, of course, there's the parts of political science that everyone needs. Which is, of course, what every citizen needs. How does a citizen participate, but also in politics? But he will also need, well, some of the knowledge of political science. But does everyone need to learn political science? I think we'll move on into that question later on. But first of all, I want to highlight this part on how is political science a science? You know, how did it become a science? Can you say that Aristotle was a political scientist? You know, he did a lot of things, you know, but when did it become a science?
Okay, so this is, I think, crucial in understanding what political science is. And this is, I think, one of my misgivings about any programs focusing on law per se, because it misses out on what the scientific aspect of political science is in the first place. It depends on how we define scientific first. So on one level, we can define it in a broad sense, which is a systematic study. Systematic means to study an object. Mm-hmm. So if it is political science, then it is systematic study of politics. Mm-hmm. That's one. But then again, you have the likes of Galileo, of course, introducing experimentation. So in the social sciences, experimentation is a bit more difficult, mm-hmm. but we are trying our best. Advances have been made on psychology, behavioral studies, on experimentation, because mm-hmm. they can actually, to an extent, mimic laboratory, you know, the laboratory conditions, because the essence of experimentation is, of course, mm-hmm. you have controlled conditions and you need to see how several variables react mm. or respond to certain impulses or certain you know, external force applied. That's how you explain. Mm. So in political science, our main mechanism for experimentation is comparative political analysis. Because mm-hmm. in comparative analysis, that's why comparative politics is essential for any political mm-hmm. science program, because mm-hmm. it teaches why and how political science is a science. Because again, you have mm-hmm. control variables and you mm-hmm. see whether by comparing different cases,
right,
you see which factor actually affects the other, given that there's mm-hmm. a set of control variables. And that's also one reason mm-hmm. why some variables right now are better considered as control variables rather than causal ones, like populism. Mm-hmm. Populism is more of a contextual variable, not a causal mm-hmm. one. So mm-hmm. Aristotle, of course, conducted comparative analysis and explaining mm-hmm. the rise and falls of different types of government. So you have, mm-hmm. And you also have Machiavelli reviving that mm-hmm. Comparative capacity. In the East, you have Sun Tzu. Mm-hmm. And sporadically in the classics, they're comparing one ruler with another in order to emphasize a point. Mm-hmm. So yeah. That's how we do it. Comparative politics is essential to political science, say science. Mm-hmm. If we define science as a means to find causes by experimentation.
Right. Okay. Because for one thing, like, especially when you look at something that's political, we deal with like deep values and beliefs of people. Mm. Because I'm going to cite Leo Strauss here, who was a philosopher, who defined politics as to speak about the best regime, the best society, or the doctrine regarding the best regime in pursuit on which the study of all kinds of regimes. So that's a quotation there. But basically, it's how to attain the best society and through what is the best regime. And of course, people have different opinions from that. So of course, while there are philosophy has its own methods, which has a lot to do with maybe evocation of emotions, of like of subjective, you know, of, it's a bit more romantic. The scientific part tries to base answer that question, what is the best regime or what is the best society, through observation across different contexts, as what you've mentioned, through comparative cases, like what is true across cases, you know, trying to control different parts. So it has this deeply subjective part, which is the politics, because sometimes you believe that society should be this way or that way, whether it be through your personal beliefs, you know, you were raised in such a way, or through your own preferences, through your own traumas, or you base it through science, which is through observation, through data, through fact finding. And I believe, again, I go back to Agpalo, he says that political science actually tries to combine moral leadership, which is again moral. We speak what is good and what is evil. It is deeply emotional, and of course, factual analysis. Sorry, it's not Agpalo. It was, I think, David Werfel, who actually was. It was during his address in PPSA, Philippine Political Science Association. So, I mean, what can you say about this balance between the subjective and the objective? Because, you come into a discipline probably with deep beliefs, and then all of a sudden you're tasked to investigate in real time, you know, the uses of power or the uses of this system. And despite believing in said system, it's failing. So what do you say about this balance between the subjective and the objective?
Okay, first and foremost, in relation to our previous topic on what does it mean for political science to be scientific, that's the usual criticism leveled against political science, that it's not a science because it's subjective. And that's the problem. You have the likes of Paul Feyerabend already stating that even science itself, natural sciences, is subjective. So the usual criticism of natural scientists against the social sciences, political science included, is that social sciences is too subjective. But then again, even the natural sciences are. So mm-hmm. it's a matter of taste. Even if the taste is backed up by data, end of the day, it's a matter of, you know, it's a matter mm-hmm. of judgment. There would always be an arbitrary judgment somewhere there. It's mm-hmm. a matter of, it's not a matter of eliminating arbitrary judgment. It's about mm-hmm. balancing out arbitrary mm-hmm. judgment. So you need to move from one vantage point, one perspective, one level of analysis mm-hmm. to another. So mm-hmm. so yeah, that's how we deal with it. But then again, I'm just summing up Paul Feyerabend on such matters.
And I think to relate to what we said in previous episodes, I think it is a mechanism or it gives us the tools to be able to question even our deep beliefs. Like if you look at, maybe you had a preferred candidate at one point, and then if you look at the data on what's going on, you can actually say that, oh, she's not, he or she is not the best.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's like, as much as, say, for example, maybe a political scientist looks at, at the golden age of martial law, if you look at the facts, you know, it, your own preferences kind of crumble in, or are tested against it. So that's the problem there.
But yeah, may naalala ko this regarding the martial. Someone posted something on Facebook and I just saw it on my news feed. Proud daw siyang maging polsay kasi lahat daw na nasa klase niya puro Marcos.
Where?
I just saw it on my news feed. I seriously, if I find, I'm gonna share it. But that's effed up. But but regarding subjectivity and objectivity, one final point. I think I would disagree with Werfel regarding balancing subjective with objective. Because that statement is based on the presupposition that there's a divide.
But it wasn't a normative claim. It's more of the... Well, no, it's more of... It was more of an observation of Philippine political scientists that there is a... that juxtaposition
in the discipline. Regardless of whether it's normative... claim or empirical
or an observation
there, that's one thing, that's something that I've imbibed from the pragmatists. There's no divide between subjective and objective. What we have is we are subjects embedded in an objective world, and the objectivity of that world that we are in depends on our own subjectivity, our own interactions with it. So it's not only about our emotions, it's about our interaction with it. To be just thoroughly subjective is to reject an objective fact, and to be thoroughly objective is to be blind to whatever subjective factors driving you in the first place. So the divide is it's an illusion. There's no divide between subjectivity and objectivity. What can be advised, however, is that you become flexible. So I think you have relative objectivity, you have relative subjectivity, and that's about being flexible. So bias, I think we've discussed this over and over again before, but the bias as something that is thoroughly subjective is about rejecting changes in objective facts, or not exposing yourself to contrary facts, or just rejecting such facts outright without integrating it. So, you know, problema dyan eh. So if you're a political scientist, if you're political science students, for our political science student listeners here, If you want to be a political scientist, it's not about achieving a level of, you know, high objectivity. You can't do that. You just can't. Because you're in a society. You are embedded in it.
Right.
What we can do, however, is to, you know, move from one perspective to another.
Right.
Assume that someone is correct for the sake of analysis instead of rejecting them outright.
Let me try and see if I got you correctly. It's not that you like be devoid of, say, for instance, an ideology. You may, for example, be in person like a liberal or a Marxist, but as a political scientist, you'd be able to see the merits and demerits of each ideology. And you'd be able to at least, well, be able to even possibly see, know the position more compassionately. Is that correct? It's not being devoid of it yourself. It's to acknowledge the perhaps even the origins and the limitations and the scope of your positions.
Yeah, you let reality tell you what is happening.
I do remember during one of my readings, like, and I think there's a parallel development between American political science and Philippine political science. Like they're in the back in the. Like the 1920s to the 1940s, the dominant movement of political science is behavioralism. It's it's mostly on causality. It's trying to look for independent variables and dependent variables. So it's, of course, the basic parts of like the scientific method, you know, it's clear there. It's a lot about empiricism, it's about positivism. Those are the dominant frameworks of today. And then all of a sudden, all these social changes started emerging. You have the assassination, I believe, of John F. Kennedy, and of course the Cold War. And so there is this new generation of political scientists that went against the traditionalists or the behavioralists and say, hey, what is the role of political scientists in political change? And so this new movement, literally called the New Political Science, or the Caucus for New Political Science, which is still just today, which tries to be more embedded in politics itself. And I think we have that same tension here in the Philippines, although it's not quite behavioralist, it's more institutionalist, because at that point, the Philippines was still building institutions or finding the institutions inherited from American colonialism. But there was this current of nationalism, which was in history, it's in literature, it's in sociology, wherein it's has a lot, it imported a lot of Marxist ideas about class, about revolution, about nationalism, about things like about things like that. And it's more how you say it responded to the urgent needs of the day. So, and there's that tension that still exists both in America and the Philippines. And the critique, of course, for activists is that, you know, political scientists, you know, major Burugis, it's very detached. You know, well, again, it's so I've been told, you know. But so what do you think about that, you know, in regards to what is the role of political scientists with regards to political realities that are, whether that be urgent or not, you know, because it's quite easy to feel detached and say, ah, this is like what happened in this period or in this theory or that theory. You don't necessarily panic as quickly as others do. And yet people might turn to you and you might have, well, what you have to say, you know, so what should we do? You know, because it's a weird thing that right now there are other disciplines speaking on political phenomena and they have something more ready to say. You know, you see the political pundits today, they're not necessarily political scientists. They're sociologists. They're historians. They're, again, interested observers who read a lot of books, but are not necessarily, they're not necessarily by discipline political scientists. So how, what then should be the role, the social role of political scientists?
Depends on, we go back to the other half of our discipline, what is political. It depends on what political is. Depends on how we define what politics is. So by anchoring ourselves on that definition, okay, let's I think let's retrack a bit, and I think we missed this out. What is political?
What is political?
Yeah.
Well, I think the again, responds to, again, the politicization of a lot of other disciplines. That's why literature students talk about the politics of, say, for example, William Shakespeare or the politics of the works of Rizal, which is, to a point, valid. But again, we have to do something. Yeah, okay, you're right. Let's go move on to the basics. And so the basics is, well, if you look at Aristotle's definition, at least, you have the trying... the activities of the state has to do with building a good society, you know. So it's how, or if you look at David Easton's definition, there's this thing called authoritative allocation of values. Now, I don't know what that means, but more or less it still has something to do with the organization of society. So, and so it's the broadest definition, but one thing I did read, and I think this is correct, is that there are as many definitions of politics as there are political scientists. And I think that is the problem, that the reason why that, you know, our discipline is somewhat splintering is because each political scientist has their own epistemic position on what politics is. Some people agree with the statement that everything is political, but you and I have discussed that already and how that's problematic. And so what at least we have hinged on is politics is about public affairs, things that are concerning a community or the citizens of a particular country, a particular state. So I think that's the simplest way. Yeah. And I think what we study as political scientists is basically the affairs within a state, how groups within that state interact, how they vie for power, how they cooperate, compromise. So do you have, what do you have to say about that?
So okay. So we have that definition of politics. Mm. But I think what would be more useful, I'm not saying that it's not useful, but what would be equally useful to that question of what should we do with society? What should we, how should we respond to activists? How should we respond to social problems? We go to Carl Schmitt's definition of what political is. So he didn't define what politics is. So he made it, he made that specific. So there are already definition of politics. You already presented some of those. It's about the public sphere. What the public is would depend through time and through history. The size of the public sphere would depend through time and through history. Mm-hmm. But for Carl Schmitt, he defines the political as simply a relationship between friends and enemies. So it is contestation. It is contestation. So if we are to define political science from the perspective of Carl Schmitt, our task is not only to study contention, it's not only to study conflict, it's not only to study public affairs or conflict within public affairs. Our task is to help identify friends and enemies. That is the implication of Schmitt's definition of what political is. So we would be a systematic, even experimental study leading to the identification of friends and enemies. And I think this is where we have fallen short. Because political scientists, for the sake of this, you know, for the sake of this trying to be objective, have reluctantly identified enemies. They would frame them as, you know, problems, or some would say puzzles, or some would say, they're there. We need to move beyond them. But the discourse of establishing enemies is something that we should be thoroughly concerned with. And now that is what other, to an extent, the commentators, pundits, activists, that's what they've taken up. They're the ones determining who the enemies and who the friends are. So if we political scientists, if we want to be, you know, if we want to be more relevant in public affairs, then we must make our stand clear on who are the public enemies. So now I'm not referring to private enemies. Even Schmitt would say that when there's difference between private enemies, we need to establish, we need to adopt that discourse. We need not be afraid to say who are the public's enemies.
You know, that is quite interesting because based on my readings, I think based on Kilhane's readings, he actually said that, you know, political science, I mean, it's actually not just Kilhane, but several sources, but one thing that he agrees with these several sources is political science as a discipline kind of thrived precisely in parallel with the development of liberal democracy. In other words, particularly in American political science, was that the reason why political scientists thrived or had jobs was because it in a way supported and was nourished and still they themselves nourish a system of liberal democracy. In other words, of course, a lot of political scientists become advisors to presidents. They have become campaign strategists in elections. They become policymakers in local governments, in systems that are liberal and democratic. Hence, that tension with, of course, anti-democratic like theories or thoughts. They seem to, like, the mainstream tends to be, or at least the traditional political scientists tend to be allergic to them. Hence, you know, that label between political science being too Burgese. So do you think that there's any truth to that, that it's being too attached to a liberal democratic paradigm?
Well,
which of course, like what you said, is based on the, how you say, the import, liberal democracy promotes a kind of plurality. So it can't really identify enemies, but more or less try to create consensus.
Yeah, that's when political science lost its balls. that's when it lost,
it lost its balls, but it became rich and multiplied. Yeah,
yeah,
that's the point.
Rich and multiplied, yet basically powerless. So that's the great paradigm of political science under liberal democracy. It is about politics, yet it doesn't know how to handle, doesn't really have power. So it's basically irrelevant. So we probably inherited that, a piece of that, a piece, not all of it, but a piece of that. Mm-hmm. Because we, thank God, we still have political scientists who are more or less activists, and those political science students who want to be activists. But okay, I think your concern is, how should we be distinct with activists? I will not. My comment on Kyohane is that, yeah, that's a position for political scientists who are basically powerless in liberal democratic societies. But for our case, since thank God we're not liberal democratic, we still have enough space for this one. If you are a political science student, and if you're a political science professor, if you're listening to this one, yeah, go ahead, be politically active, but you have an additional burden to bear. And that is the burden of scientific inquiry, experimentation. You are not only there to shout slogans or to advocate for something, you are there to measure empirically the effectiveness of your means and to understand the general schema of things. What are the causes of it? What are the roots of it? And that's an extra burden for political scientists who would like to be activists. That's an extra burden for them to carry because they have the skills for it.
Well, initially, the weird thing is that initially my concern with your statement with regards to political science being the means of identifying friends and enemies is that, does that necessarily mean the political scientists, you know, in a way dictate what the friends and enemies of the state are? Isn't that somewhat draconian or like reminiscent of authoritarianism?
It's already happening. That's what political sectors already do. They determine friends and enemies. We are joining in the fun. Do you want to leave that to pundits and to political campaigners or to politicians?
So what makes us different is our capacity for self-reflection and empiricism. So that's empirical activists.
But for my case, I will not leave that discourse. It exists. It's there, and it's dominating our politics right now. I will not leave it to politicians, nor would I leave it to dogmatic activists. I'll join in the fun. I'll find enemies of the public from an empirical and historical and comparative perspective.
Can you give an example? How does that work?
For example, if I identify corrupt politicians as the primary public enemy of more or less the ordinary citizenry, it's not only based on survey data identifying corruption as a primary problem, it's also based on the impacts of corruption on public services. It's also based on a comparative analysis of how corruption throughout different cases have stagnated the progress and economic development of their respective societies.
Let me just ask then, which comes first, the identification of elites, and then you find evidence for them to place, because again, that's what happens in, I suppose, Stalinist Russia. You know, you find enemies, you find evidence against them, or do you just take a clean sweep first and then you identify them later?
It is a cycle, and this is what separates us from dogmatists, because dogmatists they would only have one end of the cycle, which is you identify the enemy and you find evidence against. But for political scientists, we identify based on theory and based on preliminary observation who the enemies are. Then we gather data confirming who they are. And then we keep an eye on the entire thing, whether they are still enemies or not.
So does that necessarily mean that the political scientists like share in the same ideology with the state?
What ideology of the state?
Because how would you do, how well
should,
again
should we build that, ideologies?
Wait just a moment. In order for you to determine what friends and enemies are, you need to have an underlying principle, you know, internal. Don't you think? Even if you have empirical questions, those empirical questions are structured from these again moral foundations. So where do you get that? Are they necessarily synchronous with the or in line with the state?
How do we know which
political scientists to follow? How do you know which? Because different political scientists, again, would determine different enemies and different friends of the state.
It depends on the data that they have. Or is their data convincing or not? if but one again, political scientist
data, before we have data, we ask questions, and even in those questions, it can actually be either biased and unfair, or it could be again, objective and fair.
No, we have basic, thoroughly objective questions like what is. that's a thoroughly basic question. We can start from that. But regarding where is it based from, that's the thing. As far as the friends and enemies schema is concerned, that is what makes politics politics. That is what separates politics from the other spheres of human activity. Where politics, the political is the only one concerned with friends and enemies.
What would political sense. Scientists as we know them today exist in a non-liberal democratic society? Because technically, even in China, our degrees in Chinese universities aren't political science, it's public administration, which means we're not being trained as political scientists per se.
Okay, your argument is conflating my argument with authoritarian states. That's why your questions are like that.
Not necessarily. It's not conflating authoritarian. But it's only there because I'm trying to imagine political scientists in a non-liberal democratic regime. You know, so in other words, I think the reason why political scientists are able to make these inquiries is because they have the freedom to speak, the freedom to think differently.
And that is
guaranteed by liberalism.
No, that is not exclusive to liberalism.
Where else can you find that?
Those freedoms can also be guaranteed in a democracy without it being liberal. Mm-hmm.
Okay, democracy. I'd settle with that actually. In a way, political scientists can mainly thrive in democratic setups.
Fair. I'll agree with that one. But regarding your question, that's a curious question. Will political scientists exist in an authoritarian state? Probably not. I think we're usually the first targets. Either we are appropriated by the state, as was in the case of Carl Schmitt, who eventually became a Nazi, or we disappear. So political scientists, by nature, are disciplined since we are here to examine whether a public policy is valid or not, whether it's effective or not.
Right.
We are dangerous to an incumbent autocratic regime. So I do not get why political scientists end up, you know.
Before we leave this topic, I do want to know your misgivings on why not liberalism?
Because liberalism, first and foremost, eliminates the friend and enemy dichotomy. It dilutes what political means. That, you know, liberal democracy, as far as Schmitt is concerned and other critiques of liberal democracy, they're the ones, everything is political came from them. You make politics so diluted it disappears, that the question of power itself disappears.
I'm not sure that.
Yeah, as far as pluralist theories are concerned, they actually ignore the question of power in my own studies.
Well, they would identify the enemies as anyone with an extreme view, like, for example, racists or nationalists or Marxists, anything that would, again, disrupt that pluralism. So they do have enemies. It's just, again, more or less reactionary and unstable. It would depend.
It's contradictory. It's contradictory to their claims of universal rights. That's the problem with liberalism. I think that would be another episode regarding our problems with liberalism, or my problems with it.
I suppose when we discuss liberalism, but I suppose, I think both of them are necessary because it's like what you said, without liberalism, would it not be possible for political scientists to become enemies of the state and therefore no longer exist even under a democracy? Therefore, you need liberalism and democracy for political scientists to thrive.
You need liberties, and liberties are not exclusive to liberalism. Liberties can be guaranteed in a democracy, but it's a bit more, qualified. Depends on the will of the majority.
Okay, but that's an interesting topic we can go on another time. But for now, I think we should wrap this up with an important question. Mm. I mean, first and foremost, I think we've established that political science is a noble field, and it's very difficult to balance both the scientific aspect and its moral aspects. In fact, but there is this second part, which we need to get into. In other words, is it necessary for all citizens to learn about political science? I think our answers would more or less be yes. what do citizens have to learn from political science as a subject or as a discipline? And you want to go first with that?
No, I think you should go first. You're the one dealing with civic education.
I asked the question.
Okay, fine. Okay.
Like, what do you think the citizens should learn from political science?
What should citizens learn from political science? Well, first, basic concepts would be there. But I think what is important is our way of thinking. I've repeated this argument over and over again. I'll repeat it here. Opinions are cheap. Having political opinions doesn't make you a political scientist, nor does it even make you a political analyst. Having examined, empirically based, not really empirically based only, but also, you know, multidimensional opinions, or opinions that more or less extracted from different perspectives, from different vantage points, it's far more difficult. So I think that's the way of thinking that should be shared by citizens. That constancy of doubt, you know, that doctrine of doubt as the more constant one, especially in a society that's hungry for the truth. Because if a society is hungry for a truth without any measure or any effective measure of doubt, they are vulnerable to dogma, and they're vulnerable to autocrats who would profess to have truth. That's why conspiracy theorists thrive in a society without thrive in a society that is bereft of, you know, or not really bereft, but having the a malfunctioning sense of doubt, you know, the limited sense of doubt that they only doubt what the state says and they would believe what the conspiracy theorists would say. So it is that I think that should be shared to ordinary citizens, this constancy of doubt on one hand and systematic thinking. What about you? Well, what do you want to impart to citizens, since you're the one focusing on citizen specific education?
Well, I haven't thought of like what should be taught, but it's what I'm actually gathering from what citizens think. In fact, it's the citizens' job to negotiate what should be taught. Like, education is always one part indoctrination, and a lot of times like the difference between the education of citizen and of a political scientist is that a citizen needs to follow rules in order to function within it, to work within the rules, and to a certain point question, but more or less to see the law, to see and appreciate the rules and the structures. A political scientist is more trained towards, again, to doubt and to see it as with a certain level of distance. And of course, that distance can be dangerous. It can make us apathetic. But I think it's the heart of the citizen that keeps the political scientist grounded. You know, that when we know a citizen knows how one is connected with each other, but it should also have the objectivity of the scientist, in that it should be able to let go of things that work and do not work.
Yeah.
But of course, it's not exclusive to the citizens, but of course, I think it is the role of the citizen that, again, keeps the political scientist grounded, when you know that, of course, when we are concerned with what our fellow citizens are up to, when one citizen is abusing their power over other citizens, I think that's what keeps the political scientist grounded. That's a sad part, because political science has even distanced itself from political philosophy, and at least political philosophy is able to understand the soul of the citizen, you know, through its methods. You can't do that from science, but through philosophy. And I think that's I know we should have a for our discipline, we should be more holistic in our approach. We shouldn't, in our current society, objectivity is necessary with all the presence of ideologies, but at the same time, just to balance that out with the new political science and its ilk, you know, I think we should have that. that pathos of being political animals. You know, what is our stake as political scientists? I think, this is an almost different question, you know, but again, the political scientists have special tools, and of course, they're able to to use data and to use analysis for certain ends. But what those ends for, you know, that's a different set of processes. That's deciding what our values are. While my values are, of course, still like the long line of political scientists of liberal democracy, I'm open to the, and it's my responsibility as a scholar to see the debates, to see the sides. Oh, I don't know. I think I'm not sure if I'm making any sense and if I answered the question, but yeah, it's the citizen that should learn from the science, but also the science that should learn from the citizen as well.
Yeah, fair. Regarding what you said regarding being objective and education being part indoctrination, just some additional comments. I think we should be clear about this. And I think this is also time for us to ponder on it. But for my case, I find it as a responsibility to indoctrinate students on epistemological doctrines rather than political ones.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tell them
epistemological.
The nature of knowledge and truth and reality.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of teaching them, you know, that's the danger of bad training in teaching political science. You can indoctrinate students on the rule of law. You can indoctrinate them on the sanctity of certain ideas. Right. But when they see those ideas fail in public affairs, they would eventually grow jaded and apathetic. Hang on to autocrats. That's also one reason why I think some political science students who were actually proud being pro-Marcoses, they were probably taught the sanctity of leadership and rule of law. And when they see those things cracking in the real world, they hang on to a dictator. So do not teach, and I think this would be for those teaching political science and for political science students as well, be wary of this. Be wary of this. It is better to teach students epistemological doctrines. That's the only doctrine that is justifiable in a classroom. Teach them that if your teacher is not teaching you the nature of reality and the ever-changing nature of truth or facts or the movements of processes, you're being indoctrinated into something else.
Right. it's a weird thing of teaching political science. It's not the same as, you know, well, there are laws and principles, but they're not like the laws of physics. These are things that we have very little control over or can't we observe but cannot manipulate as easily. Whereas in political science, they are thoroughly human. And the nature of humanity has changed with its society, you know, almost very radically in a short span of time. It doesn't really rest on stable scientific foundations. There are no hard laws in the same way that there are hard laws for physics, but it does have the same tools as science to be able to point out flaws and to be able to adjust. I think it's a point of being objective to adjust to the changing political realities, because that's the weird thing. When you teach political science, and I think I mentioned this in episode one, it's not easy to have correct answers. Perhaps, who wrote this? Maybe there's the correct answer to that. But what is the ideal government? It's not always, sometimes it's not always democracy. Sometimes it's not always authoritarianism, although some authoritarian governments would teach that way. So at the very least, I think that's the role of political science there. It's to reflect on how to adjust to the changing realities. Not that this is the correct answer.
Some
people would say that, the other side is, the correct answer is Lenin. Isip yung ano. Well, no. I mean, there are political scientists should be able to train you to look at the flaws of what Lenin's campaign is doing.
I think as far as a pragmatist is concerned, which is something I also teach to my students, another epistemological doctrine, what is good is what works. And what works need not work for all time. So what works is also historical. So if this worked during this time, it doesn't mean that it works now. So again, epistemological doctrines, this is something that should be taught to political scientists, just to avoid the dangers of indoctrinating them from a political ideological sense. But then again, some people would say, but you're just being Burgis. And I think this is where the accusation of being Burgis would come in, that we don't teach students political ideologies. we teach students how to analyze political ideologies and make their own. So too bad for activists who are pissing you off.
Yeah. Like, and anyway, so at the at least it's, I mean, it's, I think their frustration with us is we don't join their fight in feeding the hungry, but at the same time, you know, we're just so too aware of the history and the failures of said, well, moral, moral blackmail or emotional blackmail. And I think that's another thing that political science grants you. It in a way gives you, well, to a point, it gives you immunity to the emotional appeals. It's not when emotional appeals and rhetorical appeals are not enough. You know, it has to be your conclusions should be based on hard data rather than preferences, or even like emotional appeals.
Yeah.
Even emotional appeals are subject of said science. So,
but we are joining in. I mean, we were joining in. We're also encouraging students to join in, but we have an extra burden. You have an extra burden to examine what you're joining in.
Yeah.
Challenge yun.
And this is not exclusive to political scientists. It is a skill that political science can give you.
Yep.
So, yeah. So hopefully you've learned a lot about our vocation, you know. So it enhances citizenship, but citizenship also makes political science, again, grounded in reality and could be able to
shape reality. I think
there's this great quote, I think, which talks more about Frederick Pollock in 1890. It says there that history without political science has no fruit. Political science with history knows no root. Oh, that rhymed. So I suppose that's my version of that. Citizens without political science are blind followers. Political science without that aren't citizens are just blind machines. Computing machines.
Yeah, fair.
So, we'll workshop that.
But yeah, you get the point.
Yeah.
So okay, lang anyways.
Oh, that is nice. We'll see. I'll think about it. But you know, I mean, I have not closed the door for it. But you know, and just so you know that, political science at not going to law doesn't mean we're unfulfilled. But who knows? We might be the better law students out there.
No, I actually studied political philosophy, legal philosophy, and legal theory years ago, and I'm planning to go back to those one. And I do have some former students who took up law. Who also studied legal philosophy in their free time, and they said that even their law courses have very minimal legal philosophy. So, so if you want to know the nature,
you might be
laws,
better prepared for.
Yeah,
law.
You might be better prepared for. You might go. If you want to know more about the nature of laws, just stay in political science. You don't have space to study legal theory.
Yeah, political science is more than a pre-law, but as far as pre-law go, we're still the best.
My friends who took up law school, they have a hard time writing legal research because they were forced to have very minimal number of words. Political science allows you much freedom in writing, so it's too constrained
for them. Well, at least you'll be more flexible thinkers as lawyers, because there are lawyers that are overly, how you say,
legalistic
and rigid,
and not even in Chinese sense.
Anyway, so that's our discussion of political science and its role in Philippine society. If you have other things to say about it, you may send us your emails. But for now, we shall go on to our closing segment, which is recommendations. Where we recommend some materials that might help us enrich this discussion we had. So, Borge, what do you have to recommend for us today?
Do I have any Filipino works? Okay, I didn't prepare any recommendations, so I'm just going to pull out something out of my head. Not Filipino one, so sorry. Other than Adventures in Political Science by Rimio Paloy, I mean, you can find
that one.
Yeah, UP Press. And I think we already recommended that before.
Several times, but let's do it again, because I think it's the main... work that situates political science here in the Philippines.
But for my case, I'll recommend what I've cited earlier on, which is the concept of the political. by Carl Schmitt. So if you can find an e-copy of it or a hard copy of it online, that would be great. So
yeah, it's a very short book.
It's a very short book. So it's he defines what the political is. So to those who are to those who believe that everything is political, Christ Almighty, please stop. There's much room for analysis if you would just say can be, because even Carl Schmitt can even Carl Schmitt admits that there are so many things that can be politicized, that even religion, culture, art can be political if it starts, you know, if it starts determining public enemies. So, so there's a process. So if you just say that everything is political, you're missing out on the process. And that process would actually come back to bite your ass. So yeah, better to be more discerning.
Yeah. I mean, actually, that's funny because there are a lot of, okay, that we say everything is political. Like again, I think the one recommendation that I that responds to that is, of course, I think I cited this earlier. Leo Strauss, he has a series of lectures called The Origins of Political Science. And it begins by actually saying that in order for us to have a science, it rests on the principle that the political is a specific set of phenomena, which means there is a boundary and distinction between the political and non-political. So basically, political scientists out there, you should not allow people to say that. Otherwise, you have no specialization. Walang salitang political science kapag lahat naman ng tao ng political. O ibig sabihin,
matutuloy ang prilo.
Yeah, but kapag political science ko, pwede ko mag-detect kung ano kakainin mo. As in, dietary supplement, eh,
political naman.
Everything is political. Kahit political, you know, naging political ang diet mo or dietary habits. Who knows, actually. It can be. Some people are vegetarian for political reasons. But again, it's politicization. But of course, there's a written version of that. I will put a link to that. But also, there in the University of Chicago has a webpage wherein his audio clips of his lectures are actually put up there. They're not the best quality, but you get to hear Leo Strauss's voice. And then, so yeah, there's that. And then, of course, there is the work of, again, Cohane, Political Science as a Vocation, which is a response to, again, Weber's Politics as a Vocation. It's quite short, but it speaks well to political scientists. And then you have this interesting book, which, again, informs my view of the discipline, and it kind of embodies that long history of disappointment with our It's called The Tragedy of Political Science by David Ritchie. And apparently his conclusion is precisely because the political sciences discipline focused too much on the science, but not enough on the politics, which means to determine morals. And as what you said, determine what is friends or enemies or good and evil. And I suppose...
Wait.
It's very...
Question. Did he respond to American political science?
It's based in American political science. That's precisely what he was talking about.
Okay.
But yeah, I think there is a you and I as political. It's a weird thing, you know. It's the science of morality. We try to determine what is good and what is bad, but that what is good and bad is also perhaps dependent on ideology. So it's really self. Criticism in something very deeply personal, sometimes even theological. But so it's that double responsibility that's very difficult, and that's why it's not so popular, because it's so difficult, you know. It's higher level thinking, you know. So for those who are called and still stay in political science, you know, it's it's not something that regular people do, but those who regular people who do try, you know, you're definitely get more self-aware than most people. So I think it's worth continuing this journey in political science together. And in case if you get bored in political science, I do recommend to relax this new online game called Wordle. Basically, it's just like Scrabble. You basically have to guess a five-letter word, and you know, there's tiles everywhere. So in case you're bored with political science, you can go to Wordle and you can share the results with everyone.
I've been seeing
you
have that six tries.
Exactly. You should try this yourself, Forge. So yeah, di lang puro political science. You have to be well-rounded.
My dictionary is a bit short.
And well, anyway, we'll see. It's worth keeps your brain active. And that is it. That not a bad start for our first episode of the year. Mm. We're hoping that this year will be a great one despite the challenges. We do have a lot of episodes lined up, a very special series which will begin starting next month. So stay tuned for that. If you have any questions, comments, clarifications, or suggestions for the show, please send us an email at bipodcastph@gmail.com. You may find us on YouTube, Spotify, or Anchor. But until the next episode,
magandang gabi, mga kapiay.